Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. And this week I'm pleased to say we have David Dennis on the show, and we'll be talking about his fascinating book, Inhumanities, Nazi Interpretations of Western Culture. This is a topic I know a little bit about, but not as much as I probably should. I've read some books on the topic, but I've never read one that goes into the degree of detail that David has in Inhumanities. So it was a real treat for me to read the book. And I imagine that if you're interested in the topic, and I bet a lot of you are, then you really should turn to it for insight into what the Nazis sort of thought about Western culture. I kind of put that in air quotes. I don't know if I should or not. So, David, thank you very much for writing the book, and welcome to the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's an honor to be asked to do this interview.
Sure. So could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm presently a professor of history at Loyola University of Chicago, and I focus on cultural and intellectual history, modern European cultural and intellectual history. And so my long-term experience has been to try to work out how to connect mostly the fine arts with what we define as history, which is usually a little bit more politically oriented. But colleagues will know that there are different kinds of historians and economic, political, military, and so forth. But general readers might not be aware that we do focus on particular problems. And really, ever since college, undergraduate work at the University of Wisconsin, my love has been both for history, but also for the art.
So let's get right into the book itself. And the first question I want to ask you, and the readers may not know exactly, you've hinted at the answer. What exactly is the Völkischer Beobachter? What is it as a thing?
Yes. Well, the Völkischer Beobachter was, I'm glad to say, rather than in the present, but it was the main newspaper of the National Socialist Movement. And it was a Munich political rag that pre-existed the Nazis by a few months anyway. It was just a four-page publication. But as early as 1920, Hitler had expressed the need for a newspaper. He knew that the rallies and leaflets and so on were important, and that was actually the core of his rise in popularity at the time. But this little party, he felt, needed a newspaper. So they purchased this. It was already a right-wing publication, but they purchased this quite early. And from that point on, it became the main outlet for Nazi propaganda and Nazi presentation of political positions. But then gradually it expands into a much more complete newspaper. And by the early to mid-20s, it's expanded from a four-page to an eight-page format and to a full newspaper format that includes the news, stock information. It has want ads. It has advertising. It has the weather. It has sports. It has special sections and so forth. It's a full on newspaper by the mid 20s. It's shut down during the period that they're banned after the Beer Hall Putsch. But then after that, as the party grows, so grows the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And then once they're in power, it is really the flagship media outlet for the party, and reaches a subscription level of over a million. And I tend to believe the Forvets must have had a million before that. But if you read the literature, it's stated that it was the first German newspaper to reach a million subscribers. Mm-hmm. Now, this is in the Nazi era, so being a subscriber of the paper was probably something more than suggested. But nonetheless, it did have that kind of a readership, and was, you know, I think undoubtedly, Jeffrey Herf has written in his book on anti-Semitic imagery, has strongly stated that this was the main outlet. This is the one that gave the lead to any other public media from coming from the Nazis. Now, there are people who will say, well, you know, you could also take a look at the variety of other newspapers that were out there. Most of those, though, were taken over by the Nazis, you know, subsequently, and then followed, for the most part, the same line that the Volksgesellschaft was following. It was following the line of press conference and press releases that were coming from Berlin. So, you know, the media was controlled by Goebbels, right? And then Goebbels did have the Angriff, which is another newspaper that he put out, and a couple of others, but none of them had the kind of breadth and, I think, broad impact that the Völkischer Beobachter did. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that to keep in mind is that, you know, by turning to the newspaper, you're getting one, of course, there are arguments that there, you know, of a wide range of interpretations. National Socialists, nothing about National Socialists was it as monolithic as we would think if we, you know, just considered in general popular terms. Everything was a battle. These people were struggling among themselves. Famously, Goebbels and Rosenberg, who's the editor of the Volksgesellschaft Beobachter for a long time, are at each other's throats. But they were all at each other's throats. But this is, you know, still, given all of that, you know, this would have been the public face of the party. And, you know, for the most part, you're getting the party line as such as it is, or such as it's imagined by someone like Rosenberg, who wasn't insignificant. So I think it's important to take a look at that kind of material, especially as a cultural and intellectual historian, because it gets us a little bit closer to what the general public would have been exposed to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can look at the, you know, infighting among the leaders. We can look at academic debates that are taking place in journals. And that tends to be where cultural and intellectual historians focus. But, you know, here we have an opportunity to look at, you know, the Fox News or the MSNBC, depending on whose side you're on, that had that kind of wide impact. And it takes us a step closer to what your average German was at least being exposed to. Of course, jumping the gap to find out exactly what the average German was thinking and how it was influenced by this is something that reception theorists are always trying to do. But just to, since we do have a very well-read audience, Carlo Ginzburg's Cheese and the Worms, you know, an incredible find that he could find the writings of a semi-literate Italian in the, I believe, the 16th century, to get an idea of his worldview. But it's very rare that we find that kind of thing. So we're getting closer. But the point is that the newspaper is a broadly disseminated and general representation of what it was that the Nazis wanted the people to think. Mm-hmm. And another interesting aspect of it is that in the conclusion, that's where it ended up. It could have been in the introduction, but anyway, I summarized the statistics about the authors, the contributors, and of the 1,600 articles, I'm able to identify about half of the contributors. They're, you know, these are, most of them are anonymous or just sort of non-entities. So we can see that a lot of them were academics, a number of them were journalists, and some were actually identifiable party leaders, right? But the fact that there are a lot of these are probably just doing piece work, just, you know, sort of non-entities, they might just be contracted due to these things. But what they're doing is, as Ian Kershaw said, they're working toward the Führer. They know what the party wants to hear. They know what the line is generally. So then what you read is their effort to say, okay, I need to write a commemorative article about Goethe or someone less significant like an Ernst Koenig or something like this. How am I going to do that? So in the very fact that they're sort of insignificant figures is interesting because you're getting this lower grade, if you will, perspective on how this should be done and how you can align these great figures with the main principles of the Nazi movement.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so I think these are all issues that are probably, I haven't carefully read through the historiography or theory of using public media, popular media, using the newspapers up until a certain point, then radio, television. I mean, how are we going to really ferret through cable TV and try to understand the kind of impact that it's had on our world, right? I mean, those kind of questions really should be in the minds of all of us. But it's a little bit simpler to go back. But, another thing that's important is to remember that this is one newspaper among many. The Nazis, at least until 1933 and 34, were in a struggle with every other party. And so they're putting, they're laying claim to the German tradition, their version of Western Civ, that gives them a sense of legitimacy by being able to say that they can align their principles with what they argue were the ideas of, of Goethe and of Nietzsche and of the paintings of Rembrandt and so on and so forth. But perhaps not as comprehensively, but in the same vein, so were the communists and so were the liberals. That's what I showed in the Beethoven book, that they're all doing this. So it's as complicated, or not as, but as cable TV today.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes to show that you really do have to pay attention to who's behind a media outlet and, take into consideration that there are multiple views and multiple spins being applied to not just news, but tradition, culture, history. I mean, I guess the equivalent in our world would be the consistent and inconsistent invocation of the founding fathers. Right? You can find something in the founding fathers somewhere because they were a diverse group and wrote a wide range of things to support just about any position you'd like. So, always be careful to see who's saying which founding father said what when. And that's what this book does. It provides that detail. I was glad that you said at the outset that it provides this level of specificity that there aren't really great surprises here. If German historians out there, I think we all generally agree that the fundamental principles of Nazi culture were well laid out quite well by Fritz Stern and George Mosky, and it comes out of this folkish tradition. And again, we can talk a little bit more about that. But this shows how in detail how they were able to take the writings of particular figures and give you that kind of nuanced argumentation, because it wasn't unsophisticated. I mean, these people were gebildet, that's the German term. They were cultivated, and they knew the figures. But what they're doing is going through and selecting passages or aspects of their biography that fit into the main themes of National Socialism, and then emphasizing those things. Obviously, looking for any sign of anti-Semitic. Even if it's just a throwaway line here and there, finding that in some inconsequential publication of somebody and then arguing, well, it's been a Jewish conspiracy to undermine this work, which really is one of the great masterworks. We need to pay more attention to that because it includes this paragraph where, Schopenhauer lashed out against, Jews as being cheap or something like that. This is the kind of process that they undertook, but you find out that nuance. Or you might say, well, obviously they associated themselves with Goethe, but here you find out precisely how they did it. mm-hmm. in different circumstances during the early period when they're in power, during the war. You know, there's some shift that takes place over that. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually, it was exhausting to put together, and it can be exhausting to read. It's 530 pages of this detail, but you get a feeling for that, that well, really what Hitler theorized in Mein Kampf, that process of sloganeering, of pounding away at these ideas of repetition, and what Mossi and Stern recognize as a kind of liturgical process. If you say it enough, it becomes true. And so reading through the book, you do get a feeling of that. It's a little different each time, but you continually hear that Goethe was a patriot, and Goethe wasn't a world citizen, and Goethe had an anti-Semitic streak, and Goethe was, you know, was in support of war when it was necessary, and so on and so forth. And if you hear that endlessly over 25 years of reading the newspaper, you're going to, you know, probably come around to presuming that at least there's something to that, you know, if it's not absolutely true. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's the value of, you know, one, looking at a newspaper, and even though it's just one newspaper, and it's there are other elements that could be incorporated into a comprehensive study of what the Nazis said about culture, but that's something we all have to work on together to do. And then, you know, going through those details mm-hmm. From individual to individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask a kind of open-ended question. This may be the wrong approach to eliciting what the Nazis thought about Western Civ, but when I teach Western Civ, or have taught it, I teach the students that it is, for us, from our perspective, a literary tradition. We have this canon. There are these texts that have been picked out. And it gets passed on from one generation to the next. And so I explain to the students, that's what I'm doing now. That's my role. I'm going to pass it on to you. And so we begin, actually in the class that I teach, we don't do the Hebrew Bible or anything like that. But we begin with the Greeks, and, you know, we go through the Romans, and then we go to the Middle Ages, and then we go to the Renaissance, and then we come to early modern times and the French Revolution. And I say, okay, see these texts and how Aristotle, for example, has been moved from one context to another, or how Tacitus has been moved, or how, you know, Plato's dialogues have been moved, or here you have Marcus Aurelius, and everybody read that, and, you know, that kind of thing. And it adds up to, oh, this package of texts or ideas that we call Western civilization. But it's more than anything else. It's very, I hate to use this expression, but it's very multicultural, because these texts get put into one kind of Sprachraum, you know, they get put into one linguistic context and then translated into another and another time, and so on and so forth. It's not the product of any one group of people. It's this sort of agglomeration of, again, I like this word, text of books or ideas that kind of ends up with us. I take it that the Nazis did not think of it that way.
Well, that's exactly the way I, you know, teach Western Civ. I think that and that Western Civ has become this, you know, this story, right? This story that we tell ourselves, and then, and in fact, whenever there's talk about sort of eliminating Western Civ, it's often immigrant families who they come and say, "No, we don't want that eliminated from the class, because we want our children to understand this background that we're coming from." So it's not even, but it is a construct in any case. So that would be the difference. You know, you've articulated there's those selections from different periods that shift a little bit. For the most part, though, we think of it in terms of a canon that's kind of fixed. And in general, in the United States, if you look at most Western Civ texts, although some since the 60s have brought in, you know, some other questions about groups that have been left out and principles that are hypocritical, and of course the reality that our democracy is incomplete and imperfect, but it highlights this idealized version of Athenian Greece and the republican side of Rome, and those principles of rationalism, right. A scientific orientation to things, something trending toward democracy, etc., are highlighted in that story, right?
Yeah.
But even when you teach the Greeks, one should remind people that you know, especially in generations prior to us, they knew much more about the Greek tradition than we did, and that they knew that the Greeks could also be quite vicious, could also be quite militaristic, could also be quite spiritual, what Nietzsche refers to as the Dionysian, in his effort to correct that overemphasis on the Apollonian. Right? Mm-hmm. Right? So that romantics will say, authoritarian absolutist monarchs would have emphasized perhaps more the militaristic side or the imperial side of Rome, right? So there's always picking and choosing going on, even within, you know, the Sprachraum that you've identified, yeah. Right? And so I don't shake a stick at the Germans for having their own variety of what we would call Western civ, and what in this framework is referred to as Kultur, this tradition of Kultur, that instead of culminating in the actions of Thomas Jefferson, culminated in the construction of the German nation. You know, they're constructing their own story. So coming around to the our subject, there was a pre-existing conservative German nationalistic version of Western culture that pre-existed the Nazis. And it's, in looking at this, it's important to remember that. And the Nazis really didn't make up much at all. They were just very good at synthesizing it, blending it, selling it. And, that's true of just about every aspect of their pike, including the anti-Semitism. So, that's just something that people like Fritz Stern and George Mossy showed us in the 60s, and other scholars have shown us ever since, that these anti-Semitic, for instance, principles go back at least into the 19th century, tacked on to the long 2,000-year history that preexisted that. So by the mid-19th century, coming out of the Romantic period, when the Germans are trying to construct something called a Germany out of the mass of German principalities that were unable to really put it together, right? They emphasize blood, language, and culture, okay? And that's when this story is put together. And people like Houston Stuart Chamberlain and Paul Lagarde and some others that we associate with this crazy right wing, not very well known in their day, broadly known, they're known in their own circles, are the ones that really, constructed the story that the Nazis tap into and sort of refer to. Then by the 1920s, coming out of the First World War, there's a broader range of people who understand the things in this way. You can go to the university and you're going to be taught, to a certain degree, you're not going to get the American or the British or the French version of Western Civ. You're going to have this Germanic version of it. At least that's going to be in the air. And then coming out of the crisis of the war and of the economic and political catastrophe that followed in Germany, groups like the Nazis, but especially the Nazis, take this tradition and say, let's look at this. We're not invoking this just to show you that you have a great past, but to show you that we can use this great past as a basis for moving toward a better future, for reconstructing ourselves, for holding, that's a principle that I, presented in the introduction. They're holding a mirror up to the German people saying, look how great you have been. Now we need to use those things to move forward. Now, we're going to do that by at the same time that we're going to eliminate things we don't like. So artistic modernism as a response to modernity, anything, put together by Jews or people supposedly influenced by Jews and so on, that's all going to be eliminated. So in the end, the constructive side of their project, is stillborn because they cut out all of the, the really innovative things happening. So it becomes an invocation of just tradition. Okay. So that's the broad, frame for that. I think what they do is heinous. The particular elements that they emphasize are troubling to us, but the actual process isn't, unique, right? Mm-hmm. A tradition, a culture, a society, a group, a community. I mean, it's an imagined community. So they're constructing this just as we do. Mm-hmm. That's just as we do. Mm-hmm. Now, the themes that the Nazis, you know, emphasize, that do they come out of this late 19th century variant that is referred to as folkish tradition. A strong, you know, extreme, we'll say, you know, we couldn't use this term, fundamentalist version of it, right? Emphasizing racial origins, you know, that we are German, and everything that's good and beautiful in the Western tradition has some Germanic base. Okay, so we have trouble with that, but I'm not going to try to make a comparison to things that we argue, but they lay claim to what they like about the Renaissance, what they like about ancient Rome, what they like about ancient Greece, and they say that this group of Aryans tracked their way from wherever they determined they came from in the Himalayas, across time, and were responsible at various points for these highlights. And that's how they can say that someone like Da Vinci or Michelangelo were actually Germanic, and that they can lay claim to that. The other thing that they argue is that everything is political. They are a revolutionary movement, and that's, you know, also, you know, something that the far left was arguing. But you need to be committed to something, and art itself needs to be subsumed under the interest of the state, of the country's mission. So they're always looking for some variation of patriotism, whether it be, you know, Dante's alliances to Florence or other Italian city-states, or Luther's general German-ness, even though there isn't a German nation at that time. Everybody needs to have a political... art is not to be done for art's sake. Art is done for the purposes of something national. And then... an emphasis on militarism, an emphasis on the need when necessary to fight. So almost all of these figures are scanned for some indication of what they refer to as a fighting nature. And you know, Da Vinci designed weaponry, and Dürer did a lot of military drawings, and Beethoven, you know, would get pissed off every once in a while and rail against whoever it was he was mad at every once in a while, and so forth. So you're looking for a fighting nature. You also, they also emphasize the fact that even though these are intellectuals, I put that in quotes, creative individuals, they're still in touch with their roots. They're still average human beings at the same time. And this is because the Nazis want to be careful not to write themselves into the corner of deriding what they thought of as arid intellectualism. Fundamentally, it's a populist movement, right? So they've set themselves up against these urbanite, effete, lefty, Jewish-inspired, or Jewish others, okay? So they want to appear cultivated, able to invoke all of these great figures, but they also want to say that each of these great figures was also in touch with the people, and they, you know, they like stories about Anton Bruckner, you know, getting drunk. I mean, he drank a lot of beer, apparently, and even throwing up, you know, so much. And, you know, that Mozart was, you know, a man of the people, and so on. They also strongly want to emphasize a romantic component, which, you know, comes out of the construct of the Wars of the Liberation. So what Goebbels called a steel romanticism. And that's this sort of is murky, very murky, as Germanic theory can be. But you're not doing, you know, it's not fundamentally rationalistic, it's not fundamentally enlightenment, it's not fundamentally Athenian, we'll say, it's Apollonian. It has this Dionysian component as well. And then they're always looking, just scanning over some of the major themes that run through all of their version of it, of the canon. They're looking for signs of anti-Semitic bile. And, you know, the fact is they can find it in many cases, you know, and that's a disturbing reality that, you know, Shakespeare did write a Merchant of Venice. And, you know, I don't care how you argue it, that is not a, that is not a complimentary figure. You know, Goethe did grumble a little bit when he heard about the opening up of interracial, I don't even like to use the term race involved, mixed race marriages between Germans and Jews. He is on record as having said something critical of that. The difference is that we look at that and say, well, that's kind of anomaly overall. His principles don't fit with that. And where they say, no, that's the center of it. This is what he thought, and this is the most important aspect of what he thought. The only difference between these earlier figures and us is that we understand it not in religious or cultural terms, but we understand it in scientific racial terms. So they're always saying, you know, previous anti-Semitic outbursts, or, you know, fundamentally anti-Semitic people like Luther, they came too early to really understand that it was a biological problem. So they're constantly correcting their supposed predecessors by saying, well, he just came a little bit too early. He didn't really realize that this is a pest that has to be eliminated, not something that you just complain about and take lesser measures. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, those are things that certainly a cultivated German at the time would also have at least rolled his or her eyes at, you know, that they're pushing this so hard in those directions. So I don't want to say that every German had that, but those kind of principles were in the air of this. I'll use the term fundamentalist Germanic worldview, and it was part of university education. It was part of high school education for some, just as a strong fundamentalist position might be part of a education in any town in the United States on different terms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have a question that sort of stems from my own personal experience, and that is, as I was being trained as a Russian historian in the 80s. And I remember that one of the things that we did was we would critique Soviet writings, and they always began with a kind of boilerplate. Lenin said this and Lenin said that. And they would talk about class struggle in an era in which there was no class struggle. And they would interpret popular rebellion. In other words, they were putting their spin on it too. And we would say, well, this is just ridiculous. I mean, it's risible that they would write this stuff. Some of it's okay, but mostly it's just risible. Was there anyone at the time, and I guess I need to be more specific, before 1933, were there Germans in Germany saying, this is ridiculous, they've done? And then after 1933, were there people outside Germany saying, this is obviously fantasy?
Without question. I mean, this book is, you know, and it presents itself as, this is Nazi interpretations of Western culture as presented by the Nazi newspaper. Okay. But it's important to know. The communist newspaper certainly arguing the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, before 1933, they're all, you know, fighting tooth and nail for the right to be able to invoke the German Kultur in their interest. So they're battling at that point, right? The difference being this, for all the reasons we know, this party gets in power and then is able to use the levers of a totalitarian to develop, you know, the attempt to develop a totalitarian cultural control. Okay, so then it becomes, you know, ludicrously overemphasized, just as it was in the Soviet system, just as it was in East Germany with the Marxist-Leninist stuff being crammed down their throats. And people, you know, at the time were probably, you know, rolling their eyes. I wouldn't argue that absolutely every German, you know, accepted this. It's really this minority of hardcore people who really believe it. Okay. Then there are the people who are contributing to it, maybe just in order to sell an article in a newspaper. I hypothesize that that's possible. and that people who are reading the paper, they certainly know that they're reading a Nazi paper, okay? You know, you can't miss that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, by 33, 34, 35 and beyond, you know, it really, all the newspapers are following this line, this just being the main, you know, flagship. But then you're going to be taught, you're looking at maybe a younger generation of people who've only seen newspapers that are pounding this line. Right. And my guess is that most people are looking for the sports headlines. They're looking for, the basic line of just to see, you know, what they better say in order to not get in trouble. We'll put it that way. Right. Maybe not reading each and every word of all of these arguments that I've pieced together for us. Right. But seeing those headlines, you know, as I say in the conclusion, if you're constantly reading that all the major figures are anti-Semitic, militaristic, patriotic, so on and so forth, just by dint of that being consistently reiterated, as it was in under Marxist Leninist culture in the East and so on and so forth, you know, my guess is that's how it trickles down, right? But, you know, someone like George Monti and his family, someone like Peter Gay and his family, and, of course, those are exceptional characters anyway, a liberal... who's a wonderful diarist? I will bear witness. Victor Klemperer, right? I mean, they're looking at this stuff going, this is just patently insane. For sure. Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, I've focused on the cultural history. You know, you've got to cut somewhere. But someone could, if it's a huge undertaking, I don't know. I've just finished graduate program directorship. Now I'm going to take a breath. When you ask me what I'm going to do next, actually the next thing I'm going to do is take a break from being graduate program director and figure out what I'm going to do next. Because, you know, as soon as the book came out, I took over this bureaucratic job, which is taxing. But, you know, someone should really write a comprehensive study of this newspaper. And, you know, because, something that David Blackburn asked me at the German Studies Association. He'd had a conversation with Ian Kershaw, and he said, well, how the heck do you survive studying this nasty stuff for so long? And he had asked Ian Kershaw that. I don't remember what he said Ian Kershaw's response was, but mine was, well, at least I was, you know, focusing on the high cultural aspect of things. You know, I was still somehow writing about Beethoven and Mozart. But the other thing is that if you go through this paper, you will get the crazy Nazi spin on every one of the major events, from their rise to power, you know, up all the diplomatic stages leading to the Second World War, and then each step of the Second World War. You know, you're getting the Nazi version of it. And I kept collecting, you know, the day of Operation Barbarossa, the day of the invasion at Normandy. You know, you can just see their version of all of this. And it, you know, it doesn't surprise you that it was a completely Hitlerite version of that, of each of these things. Mm-hmm. And the other stuff that the articles, consistent articles on the front page about white slavery, Jewish blood ritual, you know, they just keep pounding at the protocols of Zion all the way through,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right? So, without question, anybody but the 10% maybe or of hard fighters is going to look at this and say, eh. But of course, that's part of the story too, because so many Germans said, "Oh, you know, the anti-Semitic part, they emphasize that. It seems kind of crazy, but that's just how they're getting votes." Okay, so we can read through the rest of it and say, yeah, reunification, remilitarization, building the economy, we can work with that. But, you know, this stuff's just crazy, so we set that aside.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, I think that probably people did read the paper that way.
Mm-hmm.
And there would have been people looking at this, mm-hmm. and saying it was not.
Mm-hmm. So another question I had was, well, let me put it this way. Could you tell us a little bit about the engagement of academics and academia in the production of these articles? Because this is also a question in Soviet history. What kind of buy-in did the professoriate have to this new Soviet culture, quote unquote?
Absolutely. Well, this is an important story that has been the focus of our scholarship to this point. And in the musicology world, Michael Cater and Pamela Potter and Celia Applegate, doing a reception theory version of this, but not concentrating as much as on the popular media as I have, but concentrating on what scholars, musicologists, historians, music historians, and so on did. And, you know, the record is clear that, especially in musicology, it's really a German construct, and then it gets transferred over to the United States, and that's, you know, it's kind of hard to accept that the reason we love Beethoven and Mozart so much is because of this sort of this process. But there, you know, people have written themselves into that argument. Then, of course, others have gone on to show how ancient historians and German archaeology and Volkskunde and so on and so forth were all, you know, implicated. Now, we've already talked about the background of that, which is sort of a given that within a German world, there's this German emphasis on this sort of thing. But then as this folkish version of things becomes more, before the war, it's not entrenched, but more and more present in academia, you're going to have various scholars who have these views, getting chairs, teaching, okay? And then when the Nazis are in control and on the rise, those people and their students are going to get the positions, you see, because it's consistent. And then anybody else, any other grad student who's going to want to make, you know, a living is going to have to, you know, start writing in terms of eugenics, you know, or whatever it is. So you can sort of see how it evolved to that point. But, you know, in this particular case, aside from the journalists, clear party hacks, anonymous people who are contributing, the largest identifiable group of contributors are scholars. And some of them are notable scholars. Not people that you would know unless you knew the field, but they're people who are significant historians, significant musicologists, significant literary historians who are being contracted by the Völkische Beobachter to write these commemorative articles. And when they do, they work toward the Führer to make sure that at least some aspect of their article communicates one or more of these themes, tying the individual that they're writing about into the ideological framework. So yeah, they're involved.
Mm-hmm. So they're involved. One final question before I ask the final question, I guess that would make it the penultimate question. And that is, did any of the views espoused by or in the Völkische Beobachter or the general kind of worldview, the concern, this folkish view of history, did any of that survive the war, and can you find any of it in Germany today?
Ooh, that's a good question. Having just, explained to my daughters and other people that it was all right that the Germans won the World Cup.
Yeah,
that this is a different Germany. And
we're talking about the World Cup, by the way.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, there's this animus, of course, among my European friends.
Actually, just to break in for a second, I saw nobody where I live, which is a very liberal place. I saw many people in Argentina jerseys. I saw nobody in a German jersey.
Nobody. Right.
Nobody.
Right. No, it's interesting. My daughter said, well, that's because they initiated the First and Second World Wars. And I said, yeah, that's true. It's true. And of course, my British friends and so on. You know, ironically, the Brazilians were probably the only ones rooting for the Germans, right?
Yeah.
Because they didn't want Argentina to win for their own historical reasons.
Yeah.
But, okay. So the as you know, the dirty little secret is that a number of these figures who did contribute, you know, not just to the focus of Beobachter, but to various aspects of Nazified scholarship, continued to work afterward, were denazified and so forth. Now, yeah, writing these articles isn't the same as actually running a factory with slave labor and so on and so forth. So, I mean, this is just another version of that, you know, deeper version. And of course, we wouldn't have walked on the moon without that. So the other is that East Germany, of course, I wrote about that in the Beethoven book, shifted over to this imposed Marxist-Leninist version of things, which was just maybe even more simplistic than this, as you know. And so you apparently have a complete eradication of this Germanic view of things in East Germany, but just replaced by something else. And now that we're into, are we into the fifth generation now? I'd have to think about that. But anyway, we've had that, the theory of the three generations before you can actually confront the past in Germany and start to question the actions of the perpetrators. But I would say here's my real answer to that. It's just devastatingly sad, right, that the, you know, these bastards tainted what was the most beautiful about German culture. Now, I think that what's beautiful about German culture continues to be beautiful, but you still have to sort of justify the fact that you love Goethe and that you love the Romantics and that you love Beethoven and that you want to dedicate yourself to living. And you would like to go, you know, travel down the Romantische Straße and go to some of these places. You know, they wrought this war that flattened many of the beautiful sites in their cities. They brought that on, okay? And then they made it, questionable as to whether or not people like, let's say, a Mozart or a Nietzsche, let's say Nietzsche in particular, should be considered a great humanist or not, right? So they under in this effort, which I argue was their effort to revitalize themselves with reference to their great past, and ironically, the horrors that they perpetrated were motivated by this ideal of beauty, right? So that's the corner I wrote myself into, that, you know, that the Germans actually, the Nazis were actually doing this because they thought that they were going to render something ideal. You know, that's the horrible twist here, that all of those people died and were murdered because of an aesthetic ideal, right? So that's the corner that I write myself into in this case, right? But the fact is that they undermined it, and they destroyed it for a generation of young people, and for young Germans. I mean, it's more Americans that come in and say that they love Beethoven and Mozart, mm-hmm. and Koreans who go to Leipzig to study the music tradition. You know, it's not German kids themselves. I mean, they would much rather do hip hop. Now that might be enough, right? But I think that Germanic version. I mean, any German of a certain youth is going to roll their eyes at any implication of this kind of stuff, and that's good. But it's also sad because it also seems to involve throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I went on a scholarship once to Germany. And I was at an institute, and it was interesting the things that they showed us as sort of artifacts of Germany. They showed us films, but the films were invariably about how Germany was guilty for World War I, World War II, or some other bad thing. You see what I'm saying? They just couldn't bring themselves to trumpet anything that they had done. It was all very eyes to the ground. This is German culture.
Right.
And it got kind of tiresome, actually. You know, it just got tiresome. But I certainly can see where they were coming from. And I think you're right. They are tainted in a certain way because, you know, the words German and Nazi are so firmly bound together with the word Holocaust, I would say, that there's almost no getting them apart. And that is a tragedy, because, you know, that was a while ago now. So anyway, David, thank you so much for being on the show. Let me tell everybody that we've been talking with David Dennis about his book, Inhumanities, Nazi Interpretations of Western Culture. David, let me conclude the interview. I know you've already answered this to a certain extent. Conclude the interview with our traditional final question, and that is, what are you going to do now? What are you doing now?
Well, as I, you know, my short answer is recover from because I took on the graduate program the same year that the book was coming out, and let me just advise people, don't do that. Because that last year, when you think you're done, finishing that manuscript is actually the toughest with all of the final work that I've done. But my I'm going to follow one of my mentors, Robert Wohl's lead, I believe, and that is to try to do something very fresh, and in the sense that he went from First World War culture to aviation, because he was interested in piloting and so on, and then wove that together with his profound knowledge of cultural history to write his real survey of the impact of aviation on the arts and culture. In my experience, the big story is computer and media and the digital revolution. And I really think that we've got to try to get a grasp on that and the cultural impact of it. Of course, it's enormous. And that's why I was saying, I don't know, how are we going to figure out how we can, you know, write about the impact of cable news or something like that? But I really think that's where we need to shift attention if we're going to you know, keep up. And I think I'd like to try to contribute to that somehow. I've looked at I've been asked to do a survey, a cultural history of the impact of computing. So far, and my guess is that I would try to cut that off at somewhere at you know, yesterday. So I think somewhere there to do something fresh, but my eye is always drawn back toward you know, the issues that I've dealt with before, and probably a backup option would be to consider doing a broader history of the Völkischer Beobachter or something like that. So that would be, I really don't feel like going back into the newspaper, but if that needs to be done, I'm probably the man to do it.
Well, I wish you luck on all those projects. And David, thank you for being on the show.
Well, Marshall, it's been a real pleasure. And of course, I deeply appreciate the attention and the care. By the way, audience, he has read the book.
Very nice of you. Well, thank you again. And let me say to everyone who listens to this podcast, thank you very much for listening. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. And as I say, we appreciate your support, and I hope everyone has a great week.